This is GamesAtWork.biz with Michael Martin and Michael Rowe, your weekly podcast about gaming technology and play. The thoughts and opinions on this podcast are those of the hosts and guests alone and not the opinions of any organization which we have been, are, or may be affiliated with. This is episode 237, Tasty Robots. Good morning, good evening, good afternoon. Michael Rowe here on a Friday afternoon with my friend and co-host Michael Martin for another exciting GamesAtWork.biz.
Oh my goodness, is it ever. And luckily for us, we are not in Europe this week where things are boiling over. And here in sunny North Carolina, it's only, what, a mere high to mid-90s.
It's so, too dang hot.
Too dang hot. I was remembering that time with the no air conditioner thing, and I'm glad I'm not there.
Yep.
But we're not here to talk weather. We're here to talk tech, and we're here to talk about IT and AI and AR and all kinds of good stuff. So let's kick things off with everyone's favorite, PowerPoint.
Woohoo!
So Michael, you found this fun article from TechCrunch about how PowerPoint is getting an AI presentation coach, and that coach's name is not Clippy.
Well, the thing that I really enjoyed about it was the very first sentence of the article, and I was going to answer the question because it was like,
oh,
love it or hate it. That's easy.
And
no, but seriously, no, I hate it. And it's not just PowerPoint. It's any presentation tool, because I feel most people spend so much time focusing on what the presentation looks like, you know, what font, what color, move this over to the left. Oh no, change that. Blah 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 blah. That they forget that they're actually imparting real information by talking to people. And I know you and I've had discussions about, you know, the PowerPoint lives on,
right.
But I don't care. It should be the conversation lives on. Record it. That's, anyway, pet peeve. But I do think this is interesting. You know, Microsoft in PowerPoint for a very long time has had a capability when you're rehearsing, and I think Keynote does too, to do a timer and kind of just keep track of how long are you spending on a page, etc. But I think they've gone much, much further now on how to basically rehearse your presentation. And the one thing that's not clear is, you know, will it do things like check your speaking cadence, check your vocabulary? I seriously doubt it. But
well,
then
it
would
does,
actually
though.
Be a little bit more.
But it says it does, right?
Yeah.
Do you believe it?
No.
So I've not used this particular capability, but when I saw it in preparation for the show today, I'm like, okay, I need to check this out, because the whole notion of rehearsing what you're going to say before you do it is a good thing to do, especially when you spend so much time on getting the nuance and the material just right, and you're trying to land a particular point or be persuasive. The notion of recognizing when you're using the ums and the ahs and the here it's also talking about inclusive language. So it'd be interesting to know how the AI and what the AI actually checks for those sorts of things would be really intriguing. And I kind of wonder too, from a security standpoint, where all that is happening. Is that happening on your
device?
That's why,
you know, if this were all local on the device,
yep.
Then that might be okay. But I guess it depends on your speaking style, right? I am not someone to read charts to people.
Sure.
I tend to react and interact with the people that I'm presenting with or to, right? So I'm giving a presentation in July at a conference, and I've been working with the organizing team, and they're like, well, you know, what type of presentation, slide, blah, 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 blah. And you got this amount of time. I'm like, great. I've got an outline. Here's the outline. Right now, I think I have way too many slides. And by the way, my preferred approach for this is to do it as a Q&A, right? Present, mm-hmm. you know, half the time, present some material that kind of set up the discussion and then literally turn it into a Q&A. Right. Because to me, that provides more value to the people that you're presenting to, and it makes it stickier, right? If you're just a passive consumer sitting back and listening to somebody drone on and on, I don't care how good their inclusive language is or how many times they don't use I tune out. I tune out if it's just somebody pitching charts to me. And so,
what'd you say?
I can't remember. I was over there, it just seems like unless you're robotic in your delivery, and what I right. mean by that is it's exactly the same delivery every time, the coaching mm-hmm. is only going to provide of limited value, right? And to me, that's people so. Who sit I mean, there and focus on speaker really, notes, right?
Well, we've sat through some really painful presentations before, and some wouldn't it be a good thing? Wouldn't it be a good thing though if there was this kind of rehearsal coach buddy that could say your inflection has not varied at all since the beginning of your presentation, and that may have a couple of reasons why people might be less interested. So
hi, consider, I'm coaching me coach face. I've been listening to your PowerPoint, and you are droning on.
Bueller. Yeah. Bueller. So seriously,
Bueller.
Right?
Bueller.
So George Washington. The thing I have actually used here, and it's kind of a funny story, but I have been on Apple products for a long time, and I've only recently put a PowerPoint back on, back for the first time on a machine in a long time. And that is because I'm working with so many PowerPoint presentation files that when I read them in the keynote, make some changes and alterations, save them, share them via Box, whatever, almost every time there's something that changes that was inadvertent, color changes, font, something changes, whatever. So I'm like, fine, I'll edit natively in PowerPoint because everybody's doing that. And when you have a time crunch, you don't have a chance to mess with it. What I have noticed, what was pretty cool, is that the PowerPoint design suggestions mm-hmm. and themes, that's pretty slick. Because what it can do is it takes a table or other elements that you've got on screen and the data that you've done already, and it spiffs them up.
Mm-hmm.
And it does that like super zippy fast. And I thought, that's pretty slick. I like that.
Mm-hmm.
And I see where that usage is a plus too, because there are things that could be automated and an AI could help you do what you need to do. So you got to start somewhere. You got to learn from something. And gosh, wouldn't it be interesting if the folks over at Microsoft are like going to the large library of TED Talks and seeing from these TED Talks which ones are more engaging than others, which ones get liked and loved, what are the people actually doing? And then that synthesizes into what the presentation coach, or what do they call it, presenter coach for PowerPoint, might suggest to you as the person developing your charts to do some things that will have an impact and be better. That could be pretty cool, right?
Yeah, it's funny. You mentioned the TED Talks. There was, I can't remember if it was on Saturday Night Live, but it was how to give a TED Talk. First, throw out all kinds of interesting numbers and then talk in a low, soothing voice, but then change it.
Dramatically.
Yeah.
From time to time.
We'll have to put that comedy in the show notes because it was hilarious.
It was pretty funny. We'll have to take a look. So speaking of training.
Training.
There was an Engadget article that I saw earlier this week dealing with the situation where openly available video is being used by AIs looking to train themselves in a variety of things. And in this case, the article talks about the mannequin challenge, which, gosh, do you remember that? The 2016. I did a couple of them myself, and I was like, oh, that's kind of funny. That's what caught my eye. And apparently the benefit here is that this is a really good thing for AIs to train against to help to navigate in areas where you've got to build depth perception. Because what happens with these videos for the mannequin challenge is typically the camera moves around the room where everyone is frozen in space and time.
Yeah, I remember the challenge. I did not participate. But yeah, it's interesting. I was talking with somebody yesterday about Face ID on an Apple product, and they were saying, mm-hmm. yeah, they love it, but they really like the Face ID feature for the Windows login. I think it's Windows Hello or something like that. And I described to them that, you know, there's a significant difference between the two because most of the laptops don't have the depth sensor, right. which is why you can easily fool them with a picture. And the way Face ID works, it actually has that IR blaster that gives you the depth map of the face. The thing that was so interesting is how much better we are at getting to recreate three-dimensional depth with two-dimensional images, which is, you know, really a feature of some of the machine learning that we're doing on video and image files. So being able to figure out three-dimensional depth without actually having three-dimensional depth information is critical. And what they talk about here is really, you know, dealing with the fact that it gets harder when you're moving, right? If you don't have three-dimensional depth information, but the camera's moving, it really fools and tricks the AI. And so that's really what they're using these videos for, is to actually improve that and better navigate three-dimensional depth in moving images that are only 2D.
Well, that's really cool.
Yeah.
That's really cool. What this also reminded me of, and I'm trying to find the link for it, was this was sometime last year, I think, where there was a conference on machine learning at the University of North Carolina, and the part of what they were talking about there was they were using Twitch streams mm-hmm. as a way of doing the training for the conversational bots too.
Yeah.
Right. So there's a lot of these sort of things that are kind of it's interesting because they're all public domain. They're out there, right? There's Flickr libraries of faces to help with opportunities for training for facial recognition and more. And what the conversation in this particular Engadget article does raise is, you know, the people who shared these videos didn't necessarily share them for AR, AI training purposes. But they're there.
Well, yeah, and there's actually for that. Discovery of some bias in the algorithms because of the people who were sharing all these stuff on Flickr, right? Yeah. Et cetera. You know, they tended to be certain types of people. You know, the mass amounts of data back that was created, you know, 5 to 10 years ago on these open sharing Creative Commons environments. Who did not consent to it being used for this training because it didn't exist, right? But who are now being sucked in to train the neural networks are discovering that, hey, you know, it's a certain type of person, right? They tend to always be, well, I'm going to grossly overgeneralize a bunch of stuff, you know, smiling because people are always putting a happy face forward. So it messes up on smile detection or on frown detection, right? All kinds of little nuances based off of the bias of the data because it's self-selected data that was published. The interesting thing is I've been listening to a new podcast recently. I mean, it's not a new podcast. It's new to me. And I think I pinged you an article or at least one of the episodes. And it's talking about some of these types of machine learning machine learning algorithms, et cetera. And there were a couple of episodes back in 2016 on how neural networks are built and trained that I highly recommend. It's called Linear Digressions. Highly recommend that podcast. I've got an intern working for me this summer who actually showed me. He goes, "Oh, you like podcasts?" I'm like, "Yeah." And he goes, "Have you heard of this one?" I'm like, "No." So it'd be interesting to see their take on some of this stuff too, because it's two people who do this type of stuff in their day job constantly, and they go deep on the algorithms, the technology, the concepts, et cetera. So highly recommend it.
A cool thing to tune in and listen to. So let's definitely add that to the list, shall we?
Yeah. Yeah.
So cool. Let's move to some of the titular topics that we bring for this particular podcast of Games at Work. And that is that Harry Potter Wizards Unite, not only did it launch, it launched a day early. And
yes,
the folks over at Niantic, I guess, were like, "Hey, here it is. Let's go."
Maybe they were talking about New Zealand when they launched it.
But were they? I thought New Zealand had it already for a while.
Yeah,
and they brought it out to at least to the United States.
Yeah.
So you and I both were like, "Yay, let's get in. Let's do it." I'm curious to know what your initial experiences were, and I'll share you a couple of mine too. So what'd you think?
I'm enjoying it. As you know, if you listen to the podcast for a while, I do iOS development in my copious free time, and I'm currently on the iOS 13 beta. So that causes some issues, but it tends to be running pretty well on iOS 13, except for tracking movement. So unlocking my port keys has not been happening as fast as I expected it to. You know, I took a fairly long walk the other day that should have easily unlocked 2 kilometers, and it didn't. So I was kind of bummed by that, but I like it. I mean, it's the mechanics of it make a lot of sense. I've been playing a different game a while back that was a Harry Potter game that used a lot of the same type of spell dynamics. So when you're trying to capture the confoundables, you have to cast spells. Our favorite coffee shop actually has a wizarding challenge area, so you can do battles there. I didn't know if you knew that. So the battles are kind of cool.
I know that, but that's cool.
Yeah, the battles are cool. I've only done single player, but you can do up to things like 5 or 6 players all teamed up together to take on a battle. So that would be kind of cool to try. The one thing that they do, which I guess makes sense within the domain of the world, is there are so many different types of collections that are happening. You know, Care of Magical Creatures, Heroes of Hogwarts, blah, 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 blah. And there's, you know, 6 or 7 different types of groups in the registry. On top of that, you've got different types of potions that you can mix, so you want to do those, especially if you're doing some of the challenge battles. In order to do that, you got to collect other things that are found on the ground, or that you go to herbology and you plant them and grow them and water them. So it's much more complex of a game than Pokemon Go, but it's fun. I like it. I like it. I don't use the AR feature. You and I discussed that this morning, just because it's much easier to play if you don't. What about yourself? What do you think?
Well, so my initial take on it was I installed it, went through the initial training stuff, which kind of reminded me of that video from Saturday Night Live we watched. And then then I started playing a little bit, and so it was funny to rack up a bunch of points really fast. So my take on that was, okay, so everybody gets a ton of points really fast, make you feel a little bit better, fun, right?
And but we'll stop that soon.
Then we'll stop that soon. And then I started to try to trace the spells, right? So the notion here is that just like any junior wizard, you've got to learn how to flick and swish appropriately to cast your spells.
Levioso.
Exactly. And didn't quite work so well for me. So perhaps I don't have the wizarding touch down so much. And then I was like, okay, well, not working. The Foundable decided to be vamoosing from my screen. And I was like, all right, fine. I'll do that a little bit later. But I was doing everything with AR because the purpose was let's kind of, you know, check it out with the AR perspective. So that's kind of what I took away.
Ah. Well, you'll just have to practice and go down to the practice dummy and cast your spells on it for a while.
That may be so.
And it's not
I'm hoping I don't have to learn all these things and then memorize the way it does it.
I haven't seen that yet.
The case. All right. Well, if that's the case, that's my worry. It's like, oh, okay, I'm in training mode at least. But if I have to know that, oh, Levioso is this way and, you know, the other 16 different spells are these other ways, I don't know that I want to have to learn those gestures that much.
At least yeah, that's no, what I'm I, want. I don't see that happening. I
so
could be
let's
wrong.
Switch gears for a second and go from the world of magic to the world of science.
Woo!
And I was excited because it was reminding me of the other video that we saw from Microsoft around Apollo 11. So lots going on with Apollo 11 these days because it's that time, right? It's nearly kind of the 50th year hours. Time.
Yep.
So you found a cool AR that looked a little bit like the one we talked about also. Statue of Liberty.
Exactly. Yeah. That's exactly why I saw it. I was like, space, love it. Oh, this is kind of like the Statue of Liberty app. I should send this to Michael. Mm-hmm. It's interesting. Don't know if you remember, has it been that long? I think it was like 5 years ago or so. I backed a Kickstarter by the Smithsonian Society for Reboot the Suit, which was to refurbish and re-prepare, I believe it's Neil Armstrong's spacesuit from the initial moon landing for placement at the Smithsonian Air and Space Society Museum for the 50th anniversary. And mm-hmm. as part of that, you got 3D scans of a lot of the material, and they did some behind-the-scenes things, and they talked about the capturing of this stuff at minute detail in 3D. And I was going, they could do all kinds of cool stuff with this. And they have. They've done some really neat things with that so far. But, you know, the whole idea of taking these historical artifacts, in this case, the Apollo 11 launcher and lander and everything in between, and recreating them in 3D for you to explore and learn from is just fantastic. And so I thought it was really cool that they were doing this with Apollo 11, everything else, not just the suit. It is an AR example, right? And I don't know if I'm going to have to do it in AR. Maybe I can just do it like I normally do. But it looks fascinating. I haven't had a chance to install it yet, so I should be doing that soon.
That's super cool. And I love what you can do to just kind of build the material out from the floor and see it come together and come to life. It's cool stuff. And if I had my druthers about building, I got the message this week too about the Apollo 11 lunar lander build kit from Lego.
The and lunar Lego Lego sweet. Kit.
The lunar lander Lego lovely.
That is cool.
It's super cool stuff. And I love the size and the detail on the astronauts that are there and the gold for the legs and all kinds of stuff. And one of the reviews I read of it actually, Michael, mm-hmm. is that the little minifigs actually fit inside of the lander itself.
Cool.
So
I actually have a 3D print of the lunar lander that allows you to take the, you know, the habitat module off for blasting off in space back up to the it's really cool.
Love it.
Yeah, this is cool. I like it.
Yeah, that's like just yay. so much good So switching gears from human-controlled robotic arms and landers to human-controlled robotic arms, there is a...
and noses.
A noses. But, well, let's start with the arm one first. So there is another article you found here about a mind-controlled robotic arm that does not require surgery. But it looks like it requires a whole mess of wires to be on a hat that you wear in order to move said arm around.
Yeah.
What kind of drew your attention to this?
Well, if you remember, I think it was 2 years ago at MoogFest, there was a professor from Duke who worked with various scientists around the world to actually do the, I think he was a paraplegic who did the first kick of the soccer ball at the 2016 World Cup.
Mm-hmm.
Right? I think it was 2016. In Brazil. And or was it 2014? Wow. Anyway, and they had to do all kinds of training and using of brain interfaces, etc. And they had shown how and in the interest of science, this was fascinating. How you could combine minds to see something bigger. And the example that they were using were two monkeys, and they actually had to do surgical implants for this, to where the two monkeys' brains together would allow them to control the food dispenser.
Ah.
Right?
They had to cooperate, huh?
Yeah, but it was not natural cooperation. Right, it was literally a sensing feature. So the one monkey could see the food, but couldn't do anything with it. The other monkey could move stuff, and so together they could feed both of them. So it's kind of the hive mind mindset. And they were talking about the advances that were going on with brain machine interfaces and how they were hoping to get to non-invasive, right? So that means having very, very fine detail maps of the brain in order to figure out which neurons are firing and which, et cetera, right? And right. I've got the emotive headset, both of them, right? The larger one that gives you a lot of three-dimensional positioning of large parts of the brain's firing for things like, thinking up to 6 or 12 different unique thoughts, but full motion control requires much, much, much more than that. So the fact that they have a full, cap on with sensors across right. The entire cap is not a big thing to me. That's what you expect. And if you think about somebody who is fully paralyzed, say from the neck down, the ability to regain control of hands is just fantastic instead of just having the little puffer stick, right? And right. So this shows, and again, this is laboratory, this is initial stuff, but this shows that we're getting to the point where we're starting to be able to map the brain at a level that allows you to get that control, and that is very, very hopeful for people in that situation. Well, that's what I fascinated by this.
And while I perhaps made a little light of the look of the hat, the big benefit here, like the emotive headset, is this is a non-invasive communication protocol.
Exactly.
So
exactly.
There's no subdermal mechanism. This is all through the skin. Yeah. And that to me, I think, is pretty exciting too, that we're taking more and more steps toward what previously would have been called magic as our science advances.
Yeah, and this makes it much more available for people who need this. And again, I wasn't picking on the joking of that set because I think it's funny looking too, right? It's just that's the logical way these things progress. I mean, just remember when phones were big boxy things?
Yeah.
We all made fun of them back then.
They came with a suitcase.
Yeah, yeah. Very cool.
I guess some still do. Yeah, so this is neat, and the companion article to this that was also pretty neat was another experimental robot, but this time it wasn't a human interface. This was a mechanism to the way it was described. Also, gosh, these are both Carnegie Mellon teams, right? Well, it's UC mm-hmm. Davis with Carnegie Mellon for this one.
Yeah, but the
robot
with
and can taste. And we started talking a little bit about biosensing in the pre-show time. Let's go into a little more detail on that and what makes this so intriguing.
Yeah, it's interesting on biosensing. Actually, a couple of years back when I was at a conference at Georgia Tech with kind of the future thinkers as it relates to chips and electronics, they were demonstrating work that they were doing with biosensing, being able to do mass detection of certain drug markers by a combination of a biomass and a chip. And so you would have these wafer beds, and because of the biomass basically grown into the chip, they could do very, very fast drug detection. And so that, if you think of that and extend it to what this robot's doing, which is really about looking at detections of, quote, smells, which, I mean, a smell is just a chemical reaction, right, that we pick up with certain sensors in our back of our throat, on our tongue, in our nasal passage, etc. And right. being able to recreate that with robotic means having something that is a biochemical reaction. And that's what this sensor does from my overly simplistic view of it. What's interesting to me is the longevity that this research implies, that it's not something that can detect it just once, right? But that can mm-hmm. detect it over time, which means it has some kind of ability for self-healing, for lack of a better term, because the way it would detect it is when that, quote, smell hits the sensor, it would cause a reaction, an organic reaction, or a biological reaction or a chemical reaction, which would right. trigger something on the chip. And so the ability to undo that or, quote, heal is something, again, implied to me, at least, by reading this article. It'll be interesting to see, you know, if you think about, like, bomb sniffers mm-hmm. Or drug sniffers, you don't want to have if you have a bomb-sniffing robot versus a bomb-sniffing dog, you just like you want to keep the dog safe. You don't want to make the robot a one-and-done, right? You want to reuse right. it for the value of what it can do. And so it'll be interesting to see how this grows from a standpoint of being stable over time.
Really intriguing. And I didn't catch this upon the first read of the article, but the point that you're making about the microbiome and the way our gut microbiomes operate and the kind of really intriguing things that we're learning right now about the colonization of various good, bad, indifferent bacteria that exist within
bacteria.
People. And not just stinky stuff. I mean, just it has implications on mental health, has implications on a whole range of things that that the ability to harness these kinds of bacteria in a self-sustaining way, couple them with what we're now able to do with advanced compute plus robotics, opens up a whole range of new and intriguing use cases that allow for things that we just never even imagined before, because you might not have the right sensors that could use mass spectrometry or spectrometry to analyze the kind of things that these sort of engineered E. coli or other bacteria might be well suited to go do and be able to live long enough on the device to do their particular task.
Yep.
Huh. Very intriguing. Cool. Biohybrid bots. Wow. That's pretty cool stuff. I know we're starting to get a little low on time, but we've got a couple other things that are nice to talk about too. So we've talked about tasting, we've talked about sensing and feeling and moving. An article that I found, which doesn't give an auditory example, after we've had our
olfactory examples. Yeah, I was so disappointed about all that.
I know, it's kind of sad. I maybe have to do a little more searching on this, is the fact that a famous film composer, and this guy's name is Hans Zimmer, has been working with the folks at BMW to create the sounds for electric vehicles. And this might sound a little bit silly, too, but it is actually really intriguing to me, because the quiet of an electric vehicle is always a little kind of weird for me. And you don't necessarily want a electric quiet vehicle to make vroom sounds, because that's not exactly
you want it to go boop, 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 as it drives by.
I don't know, but it's interesting to imagine what kind of sounds would you want. Harley Davidson, I think talked about this before too. They have their sound of their motorcycles is patented, right? That's a classic sound that you associate with it. So, could you imagine what you would want an electric vehicle to sound like for you, Michael?
I think I saw it in the movie Tron.
Actually,
no. But
a little bit of a hum, right?
Yeah, it's interesting. I would. I remember a couple of years back, there was legislation being looked at to say, you know, electric cars have to make a sound, because it was scaring people. They were sneaking up on them. Right. And so having unique sound, I think that's critical. The interesting part I find interesting. Yeah, that's really good. Is will you have all these patented sounds for all these different vehicles, so you literally will be able to tell based off of the sound? And then will you have, you know, people who rootkit their car so that jailbreak their car so that they can put a different sound on, right? I don't know what mine would sound like, to be honest. I do kind of like the sound of the cars in the Tron movie. But a hum would probably be annoying, because that's, to me, is an annoying sound when I hear like a rattle or a hum while I'm driving. That's not supposed to be there.
Ah, so you've got a little U2 on me there. The thing it's funny when you reread the article, other things pop out for you. Apparently, there is a European Union, it must be law, it's a mandate, that electronic vehicles have to make a sound for pedestrians beginning on July 1st, which is only a couple days away.
Yep.
So it's not just for the inside of the car, it's the outside. And reading some of the comments against this article, it's like there's a lot of people here who are like, you've got nothing better to do. Comments. They're always fun. As long as we're on the focus of electric vehicles, there was a neat example from Engadget that you found about a solar powered electric vehicle.
Yeah, this
from
this
a Dutch
is,
company.
Yeah, this is really cool. Matter of fact, there's a link of a video of their launch of the vehicle.
Right there in the article. Yeah.
Yeah, it's like 2.5 hours long, but the first like hour plus is is nothing. It's literally a loop. I guess they started late or something. And they were they're trying to have an Apple-like vibe on their unveiling. And there's some really interesting things, and I watched about 45 minutes of it, and it was actually really, really cool. What fascinated me was, like, a couple of days before I saw this article, plus I think you and I may have talked about it in the past, I kept thinking it'd be really cool if solar-powered cars would take advantage of what we're seeing in some of the solar racers, where the hood and the roof and the trunk cover were solar panels. Right?
Why not? Right? They're exposed to the sun all the time.
Exactly. This car is called the Lightyear 1, and that's what it is. The top of all the flat surfaces, top of the car, is all solar panels. And it gets about 5 to 12... I want to say miles to the gallon, quote unquote, of charge out of that. So I think it's to the hour. So it's not going to power the thing full stop, right? The design point of the car is between around 700 kilometers on a full charge.
That's a ridiculous amount of range, isn't it?
That blows away anything on the market today. Yeah. The really interesting thing that you see if you go through the whole video is some of the manufacturing techniques and the trade-offs that they were doing around build to really kind of balance the extra weight of the batteries versus the power for the distance. They changed it, if I remember correctly, they changed it so that the I'll call it the drivetrain is on each wheel. So you don't have the heavy weight in the center there. So that can all be batteries, the physics around the aerodynamics, et cetera. And the way they've designed it is, you know, during the summer, you come home, instead of parking in the garage, leave it outside and it's charged. It's just going to be charged. Mm-hmm. And the other thing that they've done, which is unique, is to take on the problem with finding available charging stations is it can be charged with a wall socket.
Right.
So those two things, the ability for it to charge with ambient light, and that'll give you basic driving around the city or around town for no problem. Long-distance drives, it'll give you a significantly extra distance. And then the ability to wherever you stop, just plug it into a regular outlet instead of a special charging port. I think this could be a breakthrough if they actually pull it off. They're taking pre-orders. I'm going to buy two, of course, because it's only $135,000 for the base model. Maybe I'll buy three. Rotate it through the week. Yeah, but it's fascinating. I was amazed.
You know, the promise here over time is as solar gets more efficient, the theory could be that you never even have to plug in.
That's what their goal is.
I mean, wouldn't that be just something else? It's like, I don't have to gas up. I don't even have to park. I could just keep driving.
Yeah. Well, very cool.
Super cool.
So
that gets us, I think, to the end for this week. So lots of fun stuff that we had to talk about here, lots of intriguing ideas, and we would love to hear your ideas, and we would love to hear some of the things you want us to talk about more as well. So, Michael, where can people find us if they're just out looking for us somewhere?
They can find us everywhere, but the best place would be at gamesatwork.biz, our website, and from there you can get links to our Twitter account, our Facebook account, wherever. Or you know what would be really cool? Why don't you go to Apple Podcast directory in iTunes and rate us so others can find us too.
We'd love that. All right. Well, until next time, stay thirsty, my friends. I don't know.
Have a great one.
Stay cool, my friends. How about that?
Sounds like a plan.
All right. Talk to y'all later. See ya.
Bye. You've been listening to GamesAtWork.biz, the podcast about gaming technology and play. We are part of the Blueberry Podcasting Network and would like to thank the band Random Encounters for their song, Big Blue. You can follow us on Twitter at GamesAtWork_biz or at our website at GamesAtWork.biz.